Now maybe 20, 30 minutes for a little bit more answer questions and dialogue, and then we'll sit again. How's the sound? Is it okay? It's a little too loud, huh? It rings a little bit. Now that's a little okay. Is that better? One of the notes or questions that I got was from someone who just came from a long retreat doing the practice of moment-to-moment mindful noting until what seems solid starts to disappear into moments of arising and passing of experience. And when one practices in that way, in a very dedicated way in many cases, over weeks or months, experience becomes pixelated. What we take as solid becomes perceived in a very different way as the attention gets quite refined and steady, and our whole sense of our body, thoughts, experience starts to dissolve into a field of impermanence and energy and selflessness. And then the question was, all right, I had those insights. What do I do with them? Do they last? How do I integrate them? Should I make something out of them? And of course, you'll have to see. You can sort of experiment with it. But it leads to a way of understanding practice that may serve you, especially those of you who have practiced retreats over a number of years. After I had been a monk with Ajahn Chah in the forest monastery for a time, I then went to live in a Burmese monastery of one of the great Sayadaws under Mahasi Sayadaw, where we did this practice of... I did it for not quite a year and a half in silence of just noting every breath and every sound and every thought and everything until the world dissolved. And I had a lot of insights. Wow, it's all rising by itself. It has nothing to do with me. It's selfless. It's empty. It comes, it goes. There's spaciousness. All those kind of traditional insights and more. I came back and I told Ajahn Chah about my experiences. I had insights into selflessness and impermanence and Buddhist noble truths and dissolved my body into a field of energy and light. He listened. He said, oh, very good. Then he smiled. He said, something else to let go of. And that was his basic response. And in the story you can actually, and in the note, which is a very sincere question, you can hear these two dimensions again, that we're carrying paradox. One is that there is a certain kind of cultivation and deepening and opening your dedication to practice that lets you see in new ways, that lets you return from your small sense of self to a vastness or an openness or a trust of awareness or some deep insights. And then, where you're going is to be yourself, to be where you are. You let that go. And if it was genuine, and it is genuine, there are things you see that you can't unsee. You just see it, and you realize, okay, now I know this. I might forget it some of the time, but somewhere in you, you know it. Then your task is to let that understanding flower in a natural, organic way in your life by simply being where you are. And the goal in the end is not to be somebody else. It's not to perfect yourself. You've tried that, and I know. See how far you got on that one, right? The goal in another simple way is to perfect your love, to be able to be in this mysterious paradox that you are Buddha nature, consciousness, loving awareness, and also sorry, you have a personality, you know, and you have habits, and you have all of this conditioning, but you don't have to take it so seriously, you don't have to be wrestle with it and judge it and so forth, all that stuff comes, you say, oh yeah, there, that's okay. Who I am is not that. Who I am is something much more spacious and loving and free. And as you discover that, that becomes an invitation to come home to yourself in some beautiful and deep way. Hi, were you meditating?
No, I was waiting for more pearls of wisdom.
I see.
From your lips.
I see.
Can I have some water?
Yeah, sure.
Can you guys hear me okay? No. Not really.
Are you turned on? Well, did you turn that little switch on?
I switched it on, but okay. It doesn't really feel like it's on.
A tissue will light you up.
But maybe it's just not close enough. Is that better?
No, still not on, really.
That's done. How about now?
Better.
Hey, Tija, thank you. Maybe just turn it up a little bit. Thank you. How's that?
Perfect.
It sounds pretty loud to me. I don't mean too loud, I mean just good, right? Okay. So I think that now that the power is back on, it's almost, of course it's relieving, my hair is clean, but it's also almost a little disappointing because we're never happy. No. I say that just because there was something, and I don't know what it was, about having the power outage that made it seem that these 3 days we were together were much longer. I don't know. Right? It just felt like we were in a timeless realm, and it just was so much longer than 3 days. When you think 3 day retreat, it's like breathe in, breathe out, it's over. But no, it really has lasted, and a fear arose in my heart. Like, oh no, is it going to start going really fast now that the electricity's on? And why would that even make a difference? But it did, and I'm grateful that we have power, and you can all have a hot shower. That's the main thing. But also, I'm grateful. I was texting my daughter, and I was like, they're such good sports. Like, everybody was so, such a good sport about this and some of the inconveniences. And I know what Heather said was true also, that we had hot food, we had water, we had each other, we had this beautiful place, the privilege of being on retreat together. But I was really cold, so I'm happy that we can be warm again. And I had actually prepared part of a talk for Arisika, who I ran into. She actually had to leave for something, and she will be back. And so I was debating. I'll just say a little bit of what I was going to say, and then say some other things that have come up since. And Ariska's question about racism and what it also included, I think you read the whole one yesterday? I can't remember. Did you read the whole question? Oh, you didn't, right. But also what was included in her question was not just the things of the past that may need to be forgiven, but the fact that this is very ongoing in our culture, that people are, we now know about things that have been going on forever because of cell phones and cameras. We actually see videos of police shootings and horrifying things that they were always going on, you guys, but we at least many of us white people were not aware of them in the way that we are today. And so her question was really about how do we hold and deal with these things that it's not like forgiving somebody for something that happened and now it's over. It's something that is still going on. And then I found this, this is from Howard Zinn, and I think this might correspond to, at least for those of us who are older, many of our experience might be as his was. Howard Zinn, some of you probably know, he's a historian who wrote The People's History of America, and I knew him when he was alive because he was the father of Myla Zinn, who became the wife of John Cabot. And so they are Myla and John Cabot Zinn. So Howard was Myla's father. And she said, it did not occur to me when I first began, he was a historian, to immerse myself in history, how badly twisted was the teaching and writing of history by its submersion of non-white people. Yes, Indians were there, and then they were gone. And black people were visible when they were slaves, then they were free and invisible. It was a white man's history. From first grade to graduate school, I was given no inkling that the landing of Christopher Columbus in the New World initiated a genocide in which the indigenous population of Hispaniola was annihilated. Or that this was just the first stage of what was presented as a benign expansion. This is certainly how I learned it in history. We learned about the Louisiana Purchase, the Florida Purchase, we learned about the Mexican Cession, about how our country grew. But we didn't learn about the violent expulsion of the Indians, the unspeakable atrocities. We didn't learn about basically how Native people, the people, were expelled from every square mile of the continent until there was like nothing left to do with them but herd them into reservations. I mean, these are things that Howard is writing about not having. He said, we learned about the Boston Massacre. Some of you might even remember the Boston Massacre. Five white settlers were killed by British troops in 1770. He said, but how about the many massacres of non-white people in our history? And then he goes on and on, and I'm not going to go through all the massacres because we all have been sitting for a few days and quite sensitive and open, and we don't need to hear about them right this minute. But it really is important to know. It's important to bring into the room, I think, the history that we never were taught. Jack and I made a commitment last year to watch Oliver Stone's 12-part series, The Untold History of the United States. That's like, that's 12 hours. And 12 hours, like, I don't even have a TV, so I'm a laptop. And all I'll say is, don't watch it right before bed. It's not an aphrodisiac, and it's not something that will make you feel calm and settled. But I still feel it's important. You know, it's like meditation in a way. Jack found this article. I can't remember where you found it, some journal. And it said, 25% of meditators report adverse experiences. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't know any meditator who's meditated seriously who has not had a certain number of unpleasant experiences.
Only 25%?
right. But still, that's not a reason to stop meditating because some things came up that we didn't want to look at. Then that would speak to the Justin's question earlier. You know, what about the people who just, you know, sort of peel off because they don't want to see? So I just feel to bring these things into the room and be aware of them. And the other one, of course, is climate change, and I will talk a little about that tomorrow. But I did want to just answer a couple of questions because they felt important. This one is, please discuss the use of plant medicines and psychedelics to complement spiritual practice, parentheses, or distract from it, parentheses. Oh, there it is. And my colleagues might want to chime in on this one, but at Inside LA, our center in Los Angeles, we have had, I guess by now, two evenings devoted to this question, where we've invited experts on the use of psychedelics and some of our meditation teachers and had some dialogue about how can psychedelics be helpful to one's meditation practice and how can meditating be helpful to people who are exploring with plant medicines. And, you know, we have gotten some criticism for even entertaining this question, but it's happening. So again, I feel it's important to look at it. And like we've been teaching and doing, just bringing everything into loving awareness, and this is no exception. It would be very hypocritical for me, at least, to sit up here and say, well, I completely disapprove of the use of psychedelics if you're a meditator, because it was the use of psychedelics that brought me to intensive meditation practice. You know, and that's something that many people in my generation, we experienced, and we weren't really, I wasn't looking for, like, getting high and having fun experiences at that point. I really wanted to understand more about consciousness, and this was a doorway into dimensions of consciousness that I had no access to. There weren't meditation teachers and Dharma books all over the place in those days. It's hard for you to imagine, probably, but like we had two or three Dharma books total. If you weren't a scholar reading, you know, old stuff from like the 19th century translations. And we didn't have meditation centers yet. It was just the early days, and we did have psychedelics. And what I saw, and I'll tell you one experience specifically, I was with my boyfriend at the time, and we had taken LSD. I remember we were holding hands and walking up a hill. We were living on Cape Cod at that time. And it was one of those experiences of the utter perfection of everything. And it was a full moon night, and I remember looking at the full moon and thinking, the thought appeared in my very stoned mind, why do I have to take a drug to experience life this way? This is my birthright. I knew it. This is my mind. This is not, I shouldn't have to take a drug to feel this way and know these things. So that was the beginning of searching for another way. And I do feel that for people who have experimented with plant medicines, to have a stabilizing, grounding, very sane practice of mindfulness, of learning to be present with things one by one in real, quiet, unfolding time, not sped up, not amplified in any way, is just a hugely important way to integrate some of the visions and insights and things that can come from the use of the plant medicines. So you guys may want to chime in now or later on that. Do you want to say anything?
I'll just say that in one of the books I've written, Bringing Home the Dharma, there's a whole chapter that I wrote about these questions, and it starts with what you were saying, Trudy, that most of the teachers and spiritual figures from my generation, being in the spiritual industry as we are, we kind of get to know the characters, started with psychedelics of some kind or other, and it really changed the culture and it changed their consciousness. And it's powerful, and there are ways to do it, as we know now, in the right set and setting, that really enhance perception. Not for everybody, it's not the right thing, but for lots of people. And I'm very glad that it's coming back through Michael Pollan's book and other things as a responsible vision of what's possible for us. So I'll just say that much about it. I'm really appreciative of it. I'm going to say something else too, piggyback on what you were saying, Trudy. We have a number of things that are hard to hold in our hearts and our consciousness at this time. The things that you named, the fact, the ongoing structural racism and disempowerment and so forth. So if you're a mom and you have a black or brown son or daughter or something, you have to be really careful that they're not going to get shot. You know, think about that. That's our culture. Or climate change. And you look at your children or grandchildren or nieces or nephews or whatever. These are very hard to hold. And I was in this little group where we were talking about meditation practice just before this, and I have to excuse, and I hope it's all right, one of the members of the group, because he spoke in a group, I think it's okay, Bo, to describe. He was born in Cambodia and came here as a young man, and 15 years old, 14 or 15, in the late 60s. And he got to meet Mahagosananda, who is also one of my teachers, and this extraordinary figure of loving kindness and compassion after the Cambodian genocide. And I asked Bo what his practice was. He does Theravada, but he also does a kind of prayer, Pure Land Buddhist practice. And he said, my head is shaved now. And I had a practice as a young man to shave my head each time I heard about some family member who was killed by the Khmer Rouge. And then I would shave it again when I heard about another. And finally he left it that way. And I was just, I could have wept when I heard that. Because there's a way in which we also carry the difficulties of the world in our bodies and in our hearts. And what's happening as you practice here is you get a sense of your own dignity and nobility, of the spaciousness of awareness, where you can hold these, where you cannot be in denial, and where you can listen, as Trudy points to, it's not just in the past, it's now, to how you respond, how you might respond. And it gives you courage and a reminder of what's possible. Christina, trying to think of her last name, I will in a moment. We had a day on climate change here during the big San Francisco Climate Summit last year that Jerry Brown organized in San Francisco. And the person I was in dialogue with sitting up here, or maybe it was in the community hall, was a diplomat from Costa Rica, maybe somebody will remember her last name, she had helped to arrange the Rio Climate Summit. She became the United Nations Climate Envoy, and then she organized the Paris Climate Accord. So she was really a major player. And she told the story that how, when she was living in Europe trying to organize the Paris Climate Summit, it got really difficult. She was depressed. She was discouraged. It felt like a kind of darkness she was in, overwhelmed, which we all can feel. And somebody said to her, you know, you need it. you need to do something for yourself. Why don't you go see this Vietnamese guy in southern France, you know, that Thich Nhat Hanh guy. So she went to Plum Village and spent a bit of time with Thich Nhat Hanh. And he walks on the earth as if every step is kissing the earth. And he takes tea as if this was the only thing there is in the whole universe, is to have this tea with you. You know, and he's lived through so much sorrow. He's seen destruction and bombing and all kinds of things. And with it, he so treasures life. And she said, my whole system was rewired. She said that the despair and depression changed because I realized that the whole of the Paris Climate Accord was based on who was the victim and who was the perpetrator and whose fault it was. You know how well that goes in relationship. You may have noticed that. And she said, when I was done with Thich Nhat Hanh, I realized it's us, it's our family. And you know how families are, of course. They're difficult and they don't always behave. But she said, I saw it in an entirely different way. And I went back and I hunted 183 countries, and they were all my relatives. You know, like I could shave my head for every one, you know, for all the loss in them. And I could see them with the eyes of nobility, dignity. She said, and it allowed me to change the whole dynamic of the world climate work from one of contention to one that we're in it together. So this is kind of picking up on what Trudy had to say. We have these things and they're difficult to carry. They're part of our human lot right now. Maybe always have been. And we also have the practices and the perspectives and the tools to live in a different way in this world for ourselves and for the things we care about.
So we have like barely 15 minutes. Do you want to sit?
We could sit. I think it's time.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm told by my beloved that it's time for us to sit. We have 35 minutes, something like, to sit before the managers come in. And these topics, which are really so critical and relevant to us, are part of what it means actually to awaken, to be able to be present for this mysterious human incarnation, to take your seat in the midst of them all with loving awareness, compassion, sense of inner dignity and freedom. in just a minute. We'll take a break to stretch before the meeting with the managers about the end of the retreat. I remembered her name. It was Cristina Figuera, that Costa Rican diplomat. And the description of Zen Master Thich Nhat Hanh, for those of you who did not meet him, given by a fellow Zen master, was he was a cloud, a snail, and a piece of heavy machinery. And you had all those amazing qualities. Anyway, let yourself stretch, take a break for 5 minutes or so, and we'll come back.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.